Menders, Episode 7, Navigating Blind Spots and Diversity in Healthcare Training, with Dr. Dion Kim.
Something that I hear very often is, thank you for letting me know. And that personally bothers me just a little bit, in that I think there should be a sorry before there's a thank you. Personally, I think there has to be an acknowledgement of a wrongdoing before thanking me for informing.
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team? Sustain your momentum as a leader and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Well, welcome. We have Dion Kim with us today. She's a postdoctoral fellow in clinical psychology at a public sector hospital in Texas. So, Dion, I'm really delighted to have you today and just thrilled to have you with me. And I invited you to talk with me about diversity in healthcare, particularly starting to think about how increasing diversity or enhancing diversity may be a kind of a foundational approach to creating a more robust healthcare system, where we're actually able to take better care of our teams, improve resilience, improve clinician happiness, and maybe even improve our patient outcomes. So, welcome, and I'd love to hear a little bit from you about who you are and why this topic is important to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me today. My name is Dion Kim. I'm a postdoctoral resident here in the public sector in the medical center. And I think the topic of diversity in a healthcare setting is especially important to me as a racial minority. I am a second-generation Korean-American, and going through my long clinical psychology training, it's been a pretty rare occurrence for me to see another provider like me, or even during my training, and then, well, training at all levels, right, like graduate program, practicum, internship. And for postdoc, I'm in a little bit more of an urban area, so I do see more providers of color, and that's been helpful. But also, as I'm seeing a lot of patients, a lot of my patients are also of color, so I think it's important for providers to also reflect the diversity of the patients. Definitely not 100%, because especially working in a public sector, there's a lot of like socioeconomic diversity and health status diversity, I guess, that I, as a younger clinician, am privileged to experience less of. But I think it can be really important for that match to happen, or at least, even if it's not a perfect match, just to have a provider who's been on the kind of the other side of the system, or the not at the very top of that social hierarchy we have here.
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, you're alluding to, I think, some of the research that demonstrates that patients from minority backgrounds, or patients who identify as people of color, tend to do better or have better health outcomes when they're matched with providers who have similar backgrounds or other diversity elements. But I'd love to hear more about what it has meant to you, in particular as a trainee, to have clinicians that you're working with who also maybe have some overlap with your identity or, you know, some kind of racial minority. What is that like for you? Why is that so important to create safety in a learning environment?
I think something that I didn't fully appreciate the weight of, that match between myself and my colleagues, or as I'm in a training position, my supervisors even, until recently. So up until this past year, I've only worked pretty much exclusively with a white supervisor. And I felt a lot of times that I was advised in ways that made sense with that identity, even though that's not an identity that I hold myself. And I think that's an important consideration, especially as I'm doing clinical work, because how I present in that space is different due to my stimulus value and my background than if my white coworker was conducting that session. For example, I've had situations where I saw a patient that a supervisor saw kind of as a, so that I can get those clinical experiences, and my supervisor would mention, oh, that kind of presentation never happened with me. But then when they're with me, whether because I am a person of color or a woman or younger, whatever, for whatever reason, that patient would present differently with me in that setting. So I think given those differences, it's really important to have colleagues and supervisors who understand that perspective, or is aware at least of how that different presentation could happen. Another aspect I think that's I realized this year as I'm training in a more diverse setting, racially diverse setting, is provider safety. It's not a topic that I've had the opportunity to discuss with my coworkers and supervisors, because my coworkers and supervisors have all been from a more powerful racial class than I am. And so it wasn't as much of a concern for them as it was for me. And even within this current setting, as I talk about being in a more diverse setting, I was able to seek supervision from a supervisor who identifies as white, and then a supervisor of color. And it was really interesting to see the different types of advice or considerations I was given. So for example, I had a patient who said some racially charged things to me during a session. And I thought it would be important for me to document that with my white supervisor. She said, no, I don't want that. She had really good intentions. What if there's a lot of providers of color in this hospital? What if they see that comment? And what if that colors kind of how they interact with that patient?
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large, complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world, and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today.
In a detrimental way, there's no need for that kind of emotional burden on that provider or any kind of, effect on the quality of care given to that patient. And then I brought the same issue up with another supervisor of color, and what she talked about was kind of protecting the provider. I'm not very familiar with this literature, but what she told me to look into was about kind of medical lawsuits towards providers, and how there are more instances of that. I don't have this fact checked, but there are more instances of kind of lawsuits against providers of color than white providers, and how it's especially critical for a provider of color to document these maybe racially charged instances so that we can kind of look after one another. Because yes, even though we are in the provider seat, so technically of a more powerful stance in that hospital room, we don't exist in a bubble. There are several layers to our identities in the grander scheme of this American system. We are still, given the racism that's still rampant within our system and at an individual level, we're not immune to that. So coming back to your original question, I think for me to be working with other racial minority colleagues, coworkers, supervisors have been especially meaning for me in that it teaches me things to consider as well navigating this space as who I am versus as who a provider who identifies as white or a white provider does.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it really just highlights the blind spots, like systemic built-in blind spots that we have if most of our clinicians or people in positions of power or training positions are white and just don't have the lived experience or the ability to really, I think it goes beyond empathize, but like totally understand from a first person perspective what it's like to be, you know, in that position where you don't have all of the levels of power in the clinical room. And so like making sure that we bring in more diverse people kind of, I guess, levels that stratification or just could potentially help us have better informed, more supportive, more useful, better trainers, you know, in those roles that's just one level that I'm hearing from you.
And I think in addition to just better training, it would, as you talked about in the whole healthcare system, it's good for providers to feel safe, mm-hmm. right? They can't provide as well as they can if they were feeling unsafe and were constantly on the lookout for what could, I don't know, put them in some kind of unfavorable position. So I think it's important as a whole institution to focus on ensuring that everybody within the system feels safe to do the jobs that they were hired to do, essentially, as opposed to worry about everything else.
Yeah, because if you don't feel safe as a provider, as a clinician, you're not actually going to be able to do your best work. Your patient's also not going to get the best from you, and you're not going to be well. I mean, that's potentially traumatizing or damaging, harmful, especially over time as episodes or incidents build up. So one of the things that I think a lot about is how organizations can take care of employees and what organizations need to do, what kind of structures or systems they need to have in place to keep clinical employees, you know, to retain their clinical employees, to keep people in their jobs, to keep them happy, to keep them, you know, satisfied and able to give their best. And emotional safety and physical safety are two pretty critical components of organizational support. And I am hearing that when we ignore the emotional safety of trainees or clinicians of color or of other marginalized backgrounds, we're really leaving out a very critical element of organizational support so that those individuals are never going to be fully supported in doing what they're doing and are just going to be more likely to be at risk of burnout or burnout faster, or, you know, leaving to find an organization that's a better fit for their values or safer for them to be working in.
It's important also to emphasize, like, how, again, my supervisor from the example that I gave, she had really good intentions. She was very diversity-minded and all, constantly had those conversations with me. But as I think a word you used before was blind spot. And I think that's why it's so critical for healthcare systems to hire more providers of color, but not just providers of color, but maybe even like people up top, right? People who are making these decisions. There are blind spots at all levels. I think it can be hard to address them with just good intentions sometimes. So there are other options.
Yeah, no, I love that. We have to, I mean, moving beyond intentions and acknowledging and looking out for blind spots and creating a really robust level of diversity at the highest level and diversity in every way. So why do you think it's important to recruit diverse trainees?
Well, we can't have colleagues, coworkers, people up top if we already nip them from the bud, right? We need to train students of color, of sexual minority, of wide socioeconomic backgrounds, etc. If we're going to have this, I guess, diverse array of healthcare workers who can attend to all these blind spots you might have in providing care. Or I'm just even thinking about my diversity trainings overall. a lot of times when we're doing diversity trainings in higher level clinical psychology training, or maybe it's across all fields, I feel like our generation plus generation below have a lot more awareness, conversation, education about EDI related topics. And I can imagine trainees of color especially being attentive to those topics. I've had a lot of really good conversations with, you know, with trainees of all backgrounds. It, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be a trainee of color, but I've noticed, you know, there's more lived experiences and more, I guess, sensitivity to that whole spectrum of experiences as opposed to textbook. This is what we've been taught. But yeah, that, again, I think it also contributes that to that addressing blind spots, even in teaching each other and kind of growing together as clinicians, and again, hopefully eventually filling up staff positions, higher level administrative positions, making those big decisions.
Yeah, so I'm curious, if you don't mind sharing, so with the supervisor example that you gave a few minutes ago, were you able to ever have a conversation with the white supervisor about their feedback and how they're, you know, that might have been a bit of a blind spot or not necessarily been the most helpful?
I wish I could tell you, but I don't actually remember. I had plenty of other really good conversations with her, but I can't remember if I brought this particular one back to her. I had another example with her where I did have a good conversation about, if you'd like to hear that one.
Sure. Yeah. And I'm curious, like, you know, so, and I forgot to mention, I was your supervisor and I am as white as they come, you know, with my own blind spots. So, you know, on a personal level, I'd be really curious, like, how do white supervisors kind of bridge that gap or maybe come up with systems that help us to both acknowledge the fact that there are blind spots that we can't see and take actions to, you know, address those or look for those or be kind of openly discovering those as we train trainees who have all kinds of diversity elements that we don't. But I would love to hear your example as well.
Yeah, I think I could make it kind of relate. So after that happened with this supervisor, in terms of me seeking supervision, what I asked was, that happened, they made a racist comment, I froze, I was trying to do a quick intake, and so I completely glossed over the racist comment. How can I address this in the future was the top conversation we were having, and her, again, recommending from the best of intentions, from a white female provider perspective, was to tell them about how uncomfortable it makes them feel to hear those comments. So she kind of demonstrated, like, I feel uncomfortable when you make these comments. I would appreciate it if you didn't make these types of comments in the future. And that sat wrong with me as a provider of color because I didn't want it to be about my feelings. I didn't want racism to be about my feelings. I wanted it to be something that an institution of power would stand against. And so I kind of brought this up to her, given my identity factors, it's really important for me to say, like, have a little bit more to it. And so something that we talked about was, I talked about how it's this hospital's policy or some other institution or, like, it's the rule, it's the law, whatever it be, that hateful comments or generalizing comments towards racial group, etc., is not tolerated. Like, that kind of language was very important to me. And then when I brought this up to that supervisor, we were able to have a really meaningful conversation surrounding my identity and her identity and how because of the differing identities, we like there were these blind spots. Because for her, she explained to me that it was important for her to say, I feel uncomfortable, I don't want this, to the patient, because especially given the population of patients we're working with, she wanted it super clear that it was something she herself strongly believed in, or she strongly believed in standing up against racism. It wasn't something that was forced into her because institution, because red tape, because etc. And that was a very, I guess, an eye-opening conversation for me, not just in terms of, my supervisor doesn't understand the minority perspective, but even as a white provider, there are these layers to consider. Conclusion of this was I was able to have this conversation with the supervisor because I felt safe with her. So yes, she's a white provider supervisor. She doesn't share that identity with me necessarily, but she made it very clear from the start that this is something that's important to her, considering diversity factors. She acknowledged that, you know, I'm not a trainee, or I am a trainee of color, and that's not an identity she shares with me. And she's been pretty proactive about engaging in these conversations previous to this encounter. So I knew that this type of feedback would be well received. I had that sense of safety and trust. So there was kind of like that base to go off of. And I think that's something that's really important in a supervisor-supervisee relationship. A supervisor isn't going to know everything, given the big blind spot topic we just talked about. And so it's great if they are proactive and, you know, can think of, oh, these interactions can have all these different layers and be more proactive and kind of ask those questions before. And that would be great, but it's not realistic, I don't think. What's more realistic and I think a good enough or I don't know what the right word would be. What would be to kind of establish that base from the start, and not just by saying the standard lip service, like, we're all about EDI, or kind of that one intro line at the start and then never again, but you have to build that relationship. And I think that's especially important for trainees of color and other minority trainees.
Yeah. And investing in those over time, day in and day out, by just having a true, I guess, honest openness where you can create safety and have those conversations and also be totally imperfect, but in a way that allows for rebuilding, or, you know, talking through things that are challenging or not helpful that you do as a supervisor.
And I think in addition to that, like something that I found really helpful to see in my supervisors is not just them talking about diversity in a clinical setting, but outside of that as well. So for example, at this current hospital, there's like diversity initiatives for staff, or just those types of conversations. And you can see like the staff members are also engaged in that as well, versus it's just in supervision. I think something that a lot of trainees of color or other minority trainees are wary of, especially with the current climate of things, is this just lip service, or are they really for this initiative? Like how open are they to EDI work, or is it just something that looks good for them in this field? And so not just in terms of relationship the supervisors build with their trainees, I think it's also important to demonstrate how much they prioritize EDI work outside of that to build that safety and trust.
And almost having modeling.
Exactly.
Yeah, like from the absolute top of the organization and what the whole organization is prioritizing, and allowing that to like be embedded at all of those levels. Mm-hmm. And the executives and the housekeepers are, you know, both being cared for in that way as well. It's not just the trainees and their supervisors trying to like figure it out in the vacuum. It just kind of makes me think that, you know, in my own interactions with trainees, I think one of the things that I try to do is bring an openness and And I imagine a lot of supervisors do that, you know, just trying to figure out, like, you know, I don't know necessarily, or like, gee, I've had that exact experience and I also glossed over it, or I said something that I don't feel good about later, or I didn't handle it how I wanted to. And so, like, for me, trying to figure out, like, what would my trainee find empowering and help them to, you know, respond to the situation in this moment is something that's important to me. Are there things that have helped you to feel more empowered in those kinds of moments? Like when you did go back to, you know, patient care, or, you know, had your next interaction with colleague or supervisor?
I don't know if there was a specific thing that helped me feel more empowered as opposed to, again, that collection of conversations with that particular colleague. Unfortunately, I don't think I've had an instance where I felt like there was a tear in a relationship and then it, you know, it got mended. Like, I'd be friendly with staff members, coworkers, colleagues, but not, but it's hard to kind of put aside that, like, oh, there was that interaction. It becomes kind of a something you become a little bit more wary of given that exposure.
Yeah. So those moments with staff who don't create safety, I mean, it really lasts. It's not like those things are going to go away anytime soon.
Right. I just learn kind of like, oh, these are the interactions we can have. And they are fine interactions. It's just I probably wouldn't go to them if I wanted some consultation about a diversity-related topic.
Yeah. This is not a direct comparison, but the closest experience that I personally have had on that level is like with sexual harassment from patients or inappropriate sexual behaviors where, you know, when I was a trainee, I brought up, you know, different events that happened and had some supervisors who really understood and some supervisors who kind of didn't and took the like blame the clinician route. So I'm just imagining that it might have that same visceral impact, even though it's a different topic and a different level of your identity. But, you know, but for me, I guess I can identify with that lack of being able to repair relationship with certain people in terms of feeling totally safe discussing those really challenging interactions.
I guess to be fair, I just remembered one instance actually while I was training with you, Nicola, within that same institution. I did have a moment where there was not necessarily a tear, but like a inconsiderate towards diversity factors kind of interaction with a staff member. And I did have a conversation and that staff member was extremely apologetic and went above and beyond to be like, I don't want to put the burden on you, but is there anything I can do to kind of amend for, because this wasn't a patient setting, for this thing that happened. And so, and even afterwards, while I'm here, I like sent materials to that person after the fact. So I guess that's one instance when there could be repairs in those relationships if they're open to those types of conversations and willing to listen where they're not experts in. I've had instances where I tried to have these kinds of difficult conversations and as you know, been shut down either due to my trainee status or just confirmation bias was, again, something that was the most shocking to me to have heard about a racist or sexist experience. So I guess that all still points to the same important component of being willing to have that conversation, either from building the basis or even after the fact. I do acknowledge that it's really difficult for trainees to have these conversations, or somebody who's in the kind of the bottom of the totem pole to come up to staff members, coworkers, etc., to have these difficult conversations. I remember with this particular instance, I had my direct supervisor tell me that she would give me my full support if needed, and she can talk to this staff member in my place. But then I personally just chose to talk to him directly. So that can be empowering to have that support. But yeah, I guess step one, conversations are hard. So to build an environment that allows for those conversations, supervisor support, et cetera, can be one step. And also once that conversation does happen, being more receptive to it, and not just being receptive, like actually a recent thing that bothered me was when I give a feedback about something like that, something that I hear very often is thank you for letting me know. And that personally irks me just, well, low-key irks, or it's like, bothers me just a little bit in that I think there should be a sorry before there's a thank you. Personally, I think there has to be an acknowledgement of a wrongdoing before thanking me for informing.
I guess what came up for me is like apologizing, but also taking responsibility for the action that you did that was not okay.
I know there's been some social media movement or whatnot about stop saying sorry, say thank you instead. So I kind of get where that's coming from, but at the same time, I don't fully, I guess, personally agree with that, especially when it comes to racist, sexist, whatever is comments. Thank you is appropriate, especially if I'm taking my time out and energy to educate somebody. But there definitely has to be that acknowledgement, as you mentioned, before moving forward. And also, it's very helpful when they acknowledge that it's not my job to educate. It's not my job to suggest alternatives. But yes, thank you. It would be appreciated if you did help out because it's something that they want to improve and they just, again, have those blind spots.
Yeah, I really appreciate your adding that because we do need to take personal responsibility and say, you know, say I'm sorry or come in and... I think it's a way to repair a relationship. And if trust and, you know, training and supervision are really built on trusting relationships, unless like the supervisor or whoever it is, the colleague or, you know, whoever is able to acknowledge, like fully acknowledge that what they did was harmful, even if not intended to be that way, like you're not fully repairing that relationship. Well, do you have any other thoughts about how we, like how institutions or how, like how healthcare institutions or clinical supervisors can go beyond just talking about being supportive and really creating a safer and more sustainable environment?
So I think this brings me back to a point that I made earlier about how I need to see the staff members actually using their power to make institutional changes, not just in a supervision setting, but in terms of influencing change in the program. So for example, I'm a part of a diversity committee here, and that is made up of like two trainees and then all staff members. It's about like five or so staff members who are part of that team. And it's not just in terms of training the trainees that they're involved in diversity. They also engage in other diversity efforts, such as like a CEU-based training for other staff members across the nation, or it's developing initiatives within the hospital. And when I have like things that I see that might be problematic within the program, they're very willing to talk to me about it and realistically tell me what we can do and cannot do, given, you know, we're just staff members within this larger system. And they'll kind of brainstorm ideas and talk about next steps. And I think just even being willing to have those types of conversations, and I see in their own professional work outside of training that they are pushing for greater EDI work, that's, I think, what really sets the stage for trainees as they come into a system.
So having integrity in terms of what people are doing across the board.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. So my last question for you, just... what do you do to keep yourself sustainable and also to take care of yourself, given that you have had some challenging, racially charged and other sorts of difficult experiences as a trainee?
I like how everything goes back, but I think it really helps to have other coworkers who understand where you're coming from. So for lack of better words, venting, empathizing, that kind of thing can come from that more diverse coworker base or even like supervisors as well. If I don't have that, as I often didn't in my training settings, I have my friends who understand that background. So I do think that social support is really important. And I guess overall, just even if that social support doesn't exist, there's, you know, blogs, meet other media forms where that kind of experience is normalized. And it's like, it's not just a you problem. It's kind of a problem that's systematically experienced across the board. And I think that's helpful. And also, this gets draining at times, but sometimes thinking about what can I do to address this problem, even if it's like little steps. And then being in it, it's most ideal if you're in a system where those little steps would be well received. But I think that can also give a sense of empowerment. And so I guess it's also little rewards that you get, even if there's all these punishments, like it kind of keeps you going along. And then there's, you know, the usual self-care. Like, I like food. Like, so that's one. Locks.
Yeah, but sounds like you're really intentional about investing in those relationships where people are supportive of you, thinking about the things that you maybe can control or can influence, and just taking care of yourself in that system as best you can. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you sharing today.
Pleasure talking to you.
Oh, it was wonderful. Well, thank you so much. So, Dr. Diane Kim, I'm going to let you go for today and take care. Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.